Les conférences du Collège de France.
Bienvenue à tous, ou re-bienvenue pour ceux qui étaient déjà là ce matin pour la conférence du professeur Nakajima. Cet après-midi, nous avons le plaisir d'accueillir la professeure Shimazu Naoko, qui est elle aussi du Tokyo College, de l'Institut d'études avancées internationales de l'Université de Tokyo, dont elle est vice-directrice depuis août 2023. Madame Shimazu a été formée en grande partie en Angleterre, donc à l'Université d'Oxford, où elle a obtenu son doctorat en relations internationales en 1995. Elle a ensuite passé une vingtaine d'années à enseigner à Birkbeck College University de Londres. Et ensuite, elle a passé un certain temps donc à l'Université nationale de Singapour, National University of Singapore, où elle a pendant 7 ans occupé donc un poste conjoint donc au Yale NUS College, donc l'université américaine de Yale avait une sorte de branche à Singapour, et le Asia Research Institute de Singapour. Et donc depuis 2023, comme je viens de le dire, elle est à Tokyo. Et à partir du mois de juillet de cette année, c'est-à-dire dans à peine un mois, elle va commencer donc une période de 3 ans comme non-residential fellow, c'est-à-dire qu'elle sera fellow mais sans être en résidence, au Swedish Collegium for Advanced Studies à Uppsala. Donc, vous voyez que Madame Shimazu a beaucoup de tropisme européen. Et c'est pour ça, d'ailleurs, qu'elle se présente comme une historienne globale de l'Asie et comme une historienne culturelle de la diplomatie. Je crois ne pas me tromper en précisant que Madame Shimazu est elle-même fille de diplomate, hein, donc elle est née dedans en quelque sorte. Elle a beaucoup travaillé sur l'histoire japonaise moderne en se concentrant sur le positionnement du Japon dans le monde moderne, comme on peut le voir dans deux de ses publications les plus importantes, qui sont en anglais, donc « Japanese Society at War », Death, Memory and the Russo-Japanese War, publié en 2009 aux presses universitaires de Cambridge. Donc la société japonaise en guerre, mort, mémoire et la guerre russo-japonaise, par quoi elle va commencer donc sa série de cours. Madame Shimazu sera avec nous donc pendant tout le mois de juin, et donc engagée dans une série de 4 conférences qui auront lieu tous les jeudis du mois de juin, ici, à la même heure, 14h30. La deuxième publication importante qu'il fallait signaler, c'est son livre intitulé « Japan, Race and Equality, Racial Equality Proposal of 1919 », publié chez Routledge en 1998, donc Japon, race et égalité, la proposition d'égalité raciale de 1919. Et donc son projet actuel principal porte essentiellement sur donc la l'histoire culturelle de la diplomatie globale. Vous voyez que nos collègues japonais sont beaucoup dans la globalité, hein, comme c'était le cas pour le professeur Nakajima ce matin, avec donc un accent particulier mis sur le développement de nouvelles méthodologies. Et pas plus tard qu'en février de cette année, elle a publié donc un volume collectif avec Matthew Phillips, intitulé « Cold War Asia, a Visual History of Global Diplomacy », donc l'Asie de la guerre froide, une histoire visuelle de la diplomatie globale, également publiée chez aux presses universitaires de Cambridge. Et elle est actuellement en train d'achever donc la préparation de deux autres publications. Une monographie intitulée Diplomacy as Theater, The Bandung Conference of 1955, donc la diplomatie comme théâtre, la conférence de Bandung de 1955, alors ça j'y suis particulièrement sensible parce que c'est l'année de ma naissance, hein, et aussi parce que, en fait, quand vous circulez dans le monde, vous apercevez que la référence à Bandung 1955 est encore très très vivace, en particulier dans les pays africains, dès qu'il s'agit de leur rapport à la Chine, ils vivent encore sur le souvenir de Bandung. Et il faut finalement mentionner The Oxford Handbook of Cultural History of Global Diplomacy from 1750 to 2000. Donc le manuel d'histoire culturelle de la diplomatie globale des environs de 1750 jusqu'à 2000 qu'elle est en train d'éditer avec Christian Guachel. Bien, alors je vais arrêter là parce que sinon on y passe le reste de l'après-midi, et donc je donne immédiatement la parole à professeur Shimazu.
Je vous remercie de votre sympathique introduction, professeur. Être invité par l'Assemblée du Collège de France sur votre proposition est un véritable honneur. Alors, je vais parler en anglais. So, my deepest apologies for having to give the lectures in English. I have prepared my slides in French in the hope that it will make my lecture more accessible. So over the course of the next 4 weeks, I will be giving a series of lectures entitled War and Peace, A Global History of Japan from 1904 to 1943. And today is the first lecture in this series on Japanese war diaries from the Russo-Japanese War. And next week's lecture on the making of a heroic war myth in modern Japan also deals with the making of the heroic myth from the Russo-Japanese War. So it follows from today's lecture. And as I heard Professor Nakajima's lecture this morning, I was very pleased to find out that he was talking about the high end. I am talking about the grassroots views of Japan during this period. So this is the outline of today's lecture. So first, I will give a very brief background to the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-05. And then I will talk about the war diaries of the Japanese conscripts during this war. And then thirdly, I will talk about the mobilization from hometown to Hiroshima, where there was the main naval port, where soldiers got on the ships to go across to the Asian continent. And then finally, I will talk about the honorable war death. In Japanese, it's known as the Meiyo no Senshi, mostly in the battlefields. So, a very brief background to the Russo-Japanese War. So the war was a relatively short war of 19 months from February 1904 to September 1905, and ended with Japan's victory with the Treaty of Portsmouth. As soon as the treaty was signed, which ended, the Hibiya riots broke out, in protest of the disadvantageous terms of the treaty for Japan, as the Japanese government had renounced the right to war reparations. The riots subsequently broke out in many cities across Japan, and a curfew was imposed in many of these cities for several weeks to sometimes 2 months or more. So why did the war start? The primary reason was the intensification of imperial rivalry over Korea and Manchuria, which is northeast China, between Russia and Japan. When Japan won the Sino-Japanese War of 1894 to 95, it was granted the rights to the Russian concessions on the Liaodong Peninsula under the Treaty of Shimonoseki, signed on the 17th of April, 1895. And only 6 days later, on the 23rd of April, Russia, France, and Germany jointly intervened and prevented Japan from obtaining those rights in an event known as the Triple Intervention. Japan at the time was too weak to face the coalition of the three European powers. And this launched Japan into a decade of naval buildup to strengthen its military power. So the Russo-Japanese War has a global significance and attracted enormous contemporary interest as the first modern war between an Asian power and a European power. Inadvertently, the Japanese victory has turned Japan into a credible military threat in East Asia, which was a region rife with imperial competition. Some historians of the World War I regard the Russo-Japanese War as a precursor to World War I, especially in terms of understanding the importance of mobilization on the home front in Japan. So the Russo-Japanese War signifies a high point of state building because it is understood to have consolidated the monolithic nature of modern Japanese nationalism. However, the war diaries of our conscript soldiers challenge such a monolithic conception of modern Japanese society and provide a healthy evidence of historical agency from the societal perspective. So this is a postcard. The war was a very richly illustrated event in many postcards issued in Europe and in Japan. And this is a German version. And you see Japan, the woman in kimono, and the British behind the maiden in kimono. And this actually signifies the Anglo-Japanese alliance of 1902. And then you see Russia as the bear, and French, I think with the petit chapeau at the end. I'm sorry, I should have found another version. But you will see here, so the same kind of motifs and exactly the same illustrations got circulated quite a lot at the time. And this is a French version of the same half, one half of the postcard. So you could say that these are, I mean, there are so many of these postcards from the Russo-Japanese War and generally in this period that this could have been actually the height of the global postcard culture in the early 20th century. So this is a map to show where the war took place. And I'm going to see if I can work this out. Okay, so, sorry, I've got to stand. So this is an imperial war because the war did not take place on the Russian or Japanese territory. Instead, it took place mostly over Manchuria, or this area here. And so Japanese, and so the key, the main battle sites and the naval war sites were basically here, this part, and Mukden here, and the Battle of Sea of Japan, which took place here. And as you can imagine, because the war did not take place on Japan or Russia, and instead in these regions incurred a massive human, economic, and social costs as a result. Now, war diaries of Japanese conscripts. So during the war, 1.08 million Japanese soldiers were mobilized, and only 2.8% were officers. The rest were non-commissioned officers, or NCOs, and privates. And out of 1.08 million who were mobilized, 74,000 of them died. So how educated were the conscripts? 77% of the conscripts at the time received a minimum of 4 years compulsory education. And then 13% had incomplete education. And this could really be quite minimal, like the ability to write their own names and their parents' names and count up to so many. So this is why it's called incomplete education. And a lot of children were taken out of schools towards the end of first year or second year of the compulsory education in order to help the families work in the farm, or as there were many were tenant farmers. And then 10% had no education. So as I mentioned just now, a lot of the soldiers came from rural backgrounds. And at the time, roughly 50% of the Japanese population were in farming, basically. And so this meant that there was quite a widespread difficulty in recruiting soldiers through conscription, mainly because there were so many exemption clauses in the conscription laws. And this was principally to protect the eldest sons from being conscripted, because they were needed as farmhands and principal breadwinners back home. And so throughout the war in 1904-05, there were measures introduced to essentially widen the scope of conscription, i.e. by getting rid of the exemption clauses. And this happened progressively during the war, because they became short of soldiers to fight in the war. Now, war diaries I actually believe they're very important, underused personal historical source. And you can find originals in many local archives all over Japan. Japan has the most excellent kind of system of local archives, as in countries that I did research on. Japan probably has the best that I've come across. And some of these are obviously in original form in these local archives, but some of them were published by their sons posthumously after the conscript soldier died, maybe in old age. Sons will find in boxes of things and they would find a diary, and often they'll publish it. But even more often, it was published by grandchildren of the conscript who died decades before them. Now, they were written by a minority of 16% of soldiers conscripted, because they had to have a very high literacy rate. So this obviously means that most of them actually came from middle classes. Now, the war diaries, as you can probably imagine, has a beginning, the middle, and the end, except if the soldier dies. Then you suddenly see this abrupt end. And when you're going through these diaries, it's quite sort of, it's kind of emotionally quite hard, because you're getting to know the conscript by reading his personal diaries, and suddenly it stops, and you know that he must have died. Anyway, I found them to be a very precious source, revealing the inner world of these soldiers, which are often not made available. And they were consciously taken acts of preserving personal memories. Now, wartime military censorship during the Russo-Japanese War regarding diary writing was very limited. So soldiers were not allowed to put a location of the troops where they were, encampments, for obvious reasons of, you know, security. And also they were prohibited from writing socialist thoughts. So other than that, they were more or less free to write whatever they wanted in the diaries. Now, letters were different, because letters, when they, there were so many posts going back and forth between the fronts here and Japan during the war, and they were censored, so each letter would go through censors. So in letter writing, soldiers had to be a bit more careful in what they wrote, but diaries were pretty much free. And this is the last time when soldiers were allowed to write their personal diaries, because after the Russo-Japanese War, the military essentially adopts diary writing as part of their spiritual education of soldiers. So you start seeing a very kind of sort of like a template, you know, based way of writing diaries after 1905. So I think this is actually really quite a special period if one is interested in studying these materials. I'm just going to share with you one reason, or one of the privates wrote why he wanted to write a diary. So although Sakai insists on the uselessness of a diary, I absolutely insist that it is useful. Why is it useless when we can look over what we wrote later and use it for educational materials, to know the thinking of the period and to enjoy the memory of the past? Although it may cause sadness, I think it must be useful in many ways. But I think one must note everything of what one thinks in the diary. Now, I would like to introduce you to some of the conscripts that you will be meeting in this lecture. And the three on this slide were all infantry soldiers. Sawada was the first class private. He was 21 when he was called up. So this is a few years after, obviously, after he returned back alive with the picture taken with his daughters. And he came from Kanagawa Prefecture, which is right next to Tokyo. Tada is the one on the top with the cap. And he came from Toyama Prefecture, which is on the side of the Sea of Japan. And he was at the point of call-up, he was studying medicine. And he was deeply frustrated. He was one of the most frustrated soldiers whose diaries I read, because he had to stop his medical studies and restart again if he were to come back alive, which he did. Now, Mukaira was a 28-year-old father and a businessman at the time of call-up, and he was a veteran of the Boxer War, or Boxer Uprisings, or whatever you call it, of 1900. This is another soldier who was actually a medical doctor who was in the medical corps. And Doihara Michita is the one on second from the left, the one with the big smile. The thing about him, which is quite notable, was that he was a Christian. So he was not Buddhist, like probably the other soldiers were. And this actually has a sort of particular take on the way he writes diaries. He was much more critical about everything, generally speaking. Okay, so now we go into the mobilization from hometown to Hiroshima, where the big naval port was. The call-up. Conscript diaries begin almost always with the point of being called up. And almost without exception, these conscripts, they express initial ambivalence in being called up for mobilization. They were ambivalent because of the prospect of war death, obviously. And these conscripts have very many worries about their families, especially about their elderly parents and how unfilial they would be in leaving them to fend for themselves. They worry about how the remaining families, the wife and the young children, babies, will sustain family income without them, who were often the principal breadwinners. So what we see is the strength of filial piety, their strong local identity, as opposed to national identity of being Japanese, and an inner moral tension between loyalty to the state and filial piety to the family. Now, I'm going to read this part. So infantry first class private Sawada, who you saw already or met through the photograph of the two children, his heart sank with sadness on the day of departure of the journey to the front. When they went out of the gates of the barracks, nobody felt well inside their heart, feeling that they will not be back to fight in the far-flung fields of Manchuria. But he tried to think that this is for the state and felt an elated resignation. Akirame yorokobu in Japanese. So there was an undercurrent of war weariness or ensen amongst the people or conscripts who were feeling the drain from the recent overseas wars of 1894-95 and the Boxer Wars of 1900. So this is a map of Japan with the railway networks. And there are both state lines and private lines. And some of you may notice, if you've been to Japan, that the lines that you have here are often the Shinkansen bullet train lines of today. So during the war, private lines were nationalized. And you have here, so I'm just going to show you, because this is... So number 10, which is right there, that's Tokyo. And then 16 is Kyoto, 20 is Okayama, 21 is Hiroshima. So in fact, this is basically the main stretch that the soldiers went on when they were mobilized from their hometown. And where there were no lines, like particularly on the side of the Sea of Japan, essentially soldiers had to walk to the nearest headquarters where there was a railway station. So some soldiers actually had to walk quite a distance in order to even get to the point of mobilization. And one diary that I read is somebody called Negoro. So he originated from Fukushima, which is number 6. So he went through all this Tokyo, Okayama, Kyoto. He went through past Mount Fuji and all the way Kyoto, Osaka, and then Himeji, by the Himeji Castle, Okayama, and Hiroshima. So altogether, this journey was about 1,060 kilometers on railways alone. Now, the journey from hometown to Hiroshima, the importance of the mobilization journey for discovering Japan cannot be underestimated. And this is a discovery of Japan spatially through the geographical landscape of Japan. So conscript war diaries sometimes read like travelogues. And especially when they were traveling from hometown to the port, Hiroshima, we detect this palpable wonderment, sort of a joy of seeing famous sites like Tokyo, Mount Fuji, Lake Hamana, Nagoya Castle, Lake Biwa, and the Mii Temple on the shores of Lake Biwa, the largest lake in Japan, Kyoto, Osaka, Himeji Castle, and so on. And I'm just going to quote what Sawada wrote. The surface of Lake Hamana was as though it was filled with tatami mats, with the pines which lined up nearby, and the lights of the fishing boats were just like fireflies. The view was so good that I thought of drawing a picture of it. Now, some of you who have traveled Japan may have been to this famous shrine on Miyajima in near Hiroshima. And so this shrine, it's called Itsukushima Shrine, came to symbolize the ultimate beauty of Japan with a sense of venerable spiritual awe of the divine country, Kaminokuni. And it was a favorite, a favorite place of worship of the famous medieval warlord, Taira no Kiyomori, from the 12th century. and was designated as an important site of pilgrimage for the soldiers by the military in order to raise patriotic sentiment through the visual and spiritual identification of soldiers with a place of great Japanese beauty, which at the same time represented a sense of martial tradition. Hence, the Japanese army were very efficient and very effective in using the landscape to instill Japanese-ness in the conscripts. So I have a quote here from Takada, who said, "We really felt that it was truly one of the three famous views of Japan." So he's obviously in a tourist mode here, whereas Negoro, writes from another perspective, wrote about the staggering beauty of the Torii Gate, which is this red gate, which gave the impression of floating in water at high tide, and the palace-like style architecture of the shrine, as might be expected from the country of gods. So the association of physical sites with the consolidation of one's sense of identity was much in evidence. Mobilization had an unintentionally positive effect on the soldiers by allowing them to identify closer with the country simply by traveling through the geographical space of Japan. This enabled them to break out of their highly localized sources of identity and help them to develop a national one. Now, this is the second reason why the journey of mobilization was so important for the soldiers. And it was the horizontal bonding with the Japanese people that they met through their train journey. So local pageantry of farewell organized by local associations and the local elite at every railway station from hometown to Hiroshima had an incredibly big impact on these soldiers. These farewell sort of pageantry involved organizing hospitality stalls and actively distributing sweets and small kind of things to eat, cigarettes, small souvenirs to soldiers, and the role of women were incredibly important in this process. And then secondly, you would see the prominence of national cultural symbols, such as the Japanese flag, for example, and also the rallying cry called Banzai, which means 10,000 years, which united the soldiers and the people, as well as the singing of martial songs. So not only did the fervent farewells put pressure on the conscripts to buckle up and fight for the state, but they desperately needed such public displays of affection towards them as a psychologically uplifting stimulant to boost their morale, as many felt sad, homesick, and generally morose at the thought that they might never return alive. Even skeptical soldiers who had initial doubts about the call-up were overwhelmed by the sheer force of popular support. It was a critical turning point in converting even the most skeptical soldiers to feel patriotic, at least momentarily, during their passage through Japan. So I'm just going to read two excerpts. First is Tada from Toyama. On leaving the Shinbashi station in Tokyo, everyone was shouting the farewell banzai with such a force that we thought it was going to attack us. All these great voices of banzai imply that the kokumin, or the Japanese people, are expecting victory from us. We must absolutely win for the country, as we have received continuously these congratulatory words from the people since we departed the barracks. And then Sawada talked about the famous Kyoto beauties from the Patriotic Ladies Association, who welcomed them in formal kimono attire. With Comrade in Arms, we talked about the warm reception we were all receiving because we were going to the battlefield to fight for the kokka or the country, even if it meant disappearing as Jews in the fields of Manchuria. So many were full of tears and became emotional, and some wrote, everyone secretly vowed to their heart that even if one were to experience the hardship of seven deaths and seven lives, we had to defeat the enemy. So these are some of the scenes from the farewell that I've been talking about. And this is actually from Minamitama County in the outskirts of Tokyo. It looks very rural, but Tokyo does have very rural kind of mountainous regions. And you see the banners, and they would normally say things like, you know, victory for our soldiers, and so on. And these banners become very important as sort of like symbols of farewell and so on. And this is a print, Japanese print, of prayers that local people made at the local shrine, Shinto shrine, for victory. And but the newspapers of the time often wrote about these families who were made to go and pray for the victory of Japan in the war, outwardly, but privately they were praying for their sons to come back safe and able-bodied. So just as a summary on mobilization, certainly soldiers were no fools as they realized that their newly gained status as defenders had privileged them with a special treatment from the nation. They felt truly grateful for it, and in return began to feel depended upon as defenders of these very people who fervently waved at them. Now they felt part of the nation. Hence the long journey of farewell produced a fundamental transformation in the identity of the soldiers as they acquired the sensibility to identify with the Japanese people at large. The spontaneous development of the horizontal bonding of the ordinary Japanese people, both as soldiers and as well-wishers, was the miracle even the most fervently nationalistic bureaucrat in the Ministry of the Army or Navy could not have hoped to achieve through normal measures. Now, most importantly, in this crucial transformation, not one soldier ever mentioned the emperor. Now we go to the topic of honorable war death, Meiyo no Senshi in Japanese. And basically, I'm going to refer to it in relation to the battlefield fighting. So this term, honorable war death, was a rhetorical invention of the Russo-Japanese War. And it began to circulate in the official discourse and the media soon after the war broke out in February 1904. So what did honorable war death mean to contemporaries? Most crucially, how convincing was its argument for the conscripts? So honorable war death, in honorable war death, the army sought to construct a relationship between the conscript and the emperor in order to foster the idealized devotional loyalty of the soldier to the emperor, notionally similar to the feudal master-servant relationship that existed in the former samurai culture. But the prioritization of honor as a value concept for the conscripts that you've already met and I've talked about can only be described as a crude imposition of the highly idealized cultural value of the former samurai elite, consisting of only 5.7% of the population, on the majority of the Japanese, for whom these values remained alien and irrelevant to the daily existence. So conscripts, as you know by now, mostly came from the lower socioeconomic backgrounds and operated in a different system of social cultural values that placed at its core the concept of filial piety, which meant that they felt the strongest sense of duty towards the family. In fact, the state constantly struggled to convince the people that their primary duty should be to the state and not to the family. So I'm going to quote, this is the medical corps doctor, Doihara Michita. So what did he think about this official rhetoric? He said, "It makes me so angry to read about the so-called honorable war death in the newspapers. As long as human beings are alive, we find no one who finds happiness in death and sadness in being alive. Everyone likes to return without being dead. However, journalists write as though soldiers like to die. It's outrageous." And here's another, Superior Private Mozawa. He said, "Soldiering is an honorable occupation. People respect honor. But if one were to know what lies behind it, then one may no longer think thus. If you think of honor, observe what's behind it." So nearly all soldiers saw through the hollowness of the rhetoric of honorable war death. The rhetoric of official nationalism, as in this case of honorable war death, sat uncomfortably and precariously on top of the deeply entrenched social value of duty to the family and local community. So now we move to the battlefield. In general, what's very interesting about conscript diaries is that although they were very frightened of dying, they genuinely thought that they would not die. And conscripts, so therefore, considered battlefield death to be unnatural, because obviously you're not dying in your normal circumstances. And therefore, it was something unlucky, unga wari in Japanese. And the sense that one could not die so easily because they were being protected by amulets, and many of them had so many amulets that they were bulging out of pockets. And you read about some of the bullets hitting the pocket full of amulets, and they were saved from death. And also other folk religious beliefs, like that print you saw of the prayers at the local shrine. And so they felt that the whole local community was praying for them. So somehow they felt a sense of protection. But when they actually confronted battlefield death, themes of grief and loneliness pervaded. So here's a quote from Takada, who was a first-class private, who wrote about the horrifying tragedy of battlefield death. And I quote, "Oh, even though it is the duty of soldiers to separate from fathers, mothers, wives, and children, far away from home, as defenders of the state, and we take for granted that we get hit by enemy bullets and be buried in a foreign land, what would their families feel if they only knew how tragic reality was?" So the emphasis not only on the inseparable link that soldiers felt with their families, but also the well of loneliness emanating from being buried in a foreign land, away from the family, is very prominent in their diaries. And in fact, this sense of loneliness of death is a universal theme in the treatment of war death in their diaries. Another way of putting it would be to say that the death, especially of a comrade in arms from hometown, represented a psychological break between home, which is the sort of which represented permanence in the mind of soldiers, and the front, which represented impermanence, and as symbolized by the physical presence at the front of their friend from hometown as a comrade in arms. And with the death of this friend, another tangible link with home was being cut off from the soldiers, for the soldier. So this is a photograph of the soldiers at the front. And as you see, there are already sort of half trenches in this period. If you know anything about the First World War, the trenches during the First World War was much deeper. And it was almost like a semi-underground kind of, you know, tunnels, and almost like a little city. But during the Russo-Japanese War, it wasn't deep at all. So they would just dig enough so that they could sort of position themselves and have rifles and hit from the top. And this is obviously a scene after some battle, because you see some abandoned uniforms of the soldiers, as well as some of the weapons and so on. And then, sorry, I'm going to, sorry, did I? Oh, yes. And then, of course, as the battle goes on, soldiers see, come across, confront very many absolutely horrible scenes. And so gruesome details of battlefield deaths expressing shock of the disposal of bodies is particularly prominent in their writing. So they don't actually describe very much about the, like, the moment of death or the actual, how they looked like often, but they often wrote about how the bodies of the dead on both sides, both the Russians and the Japanese, were dealt with in the front. So here I quote, "Nobody cleared up the dead bodies of the Russian soldiers, which were left alone. And even the holes quickly dug up to bury them had been dug up and scavenged by stray dogs. And the sight is too horrible to look at. The bodies of the dead Japanese soldiers, which had been buried in the valleys, were also not so deep, which meant that hands and feet were sticking out." So these kinds of scenes of moral repugnance occurred on a daily basis in wartime situations. And soldiers would soon become brutalized and accustomed to seeing horrifically violent death in multitude. So this is a rather unusual photograph taken by the army photograph unit. And this is a scene after the battle, as you can see, and there's some dead bodies in trenches. But what's quite striking about many of these photographs from the photograph unit of the army is how the soldiers look, in a sense that they sort of look bored. They're standing around, you know. And in fact, it's quite placid. And this is one of the sort of not kind of emotionally involved, not sort of, they sort of look like they're just standing around waiting, what are we going to do now, you know, that sort of thing. So this, but even then, it's actually quite difficult to find photos of this kind. Now, what happens to soldiers when they die? Funerary and commemorative process of the war dead from the Russo-Japanese War. This is a very important topic for the army in particular, and navy as well, but not army in particular, because in order for the army to demonstrate the value of the individual war death as heroic war death and sacrifices made by them, and obviously their families back home, it developed an extensive funerary and commemorative rituals. And it all begins at the battlefields, at the front. And one of the really striking things about this period is that all official funerals were done in the Shinto style and not in the Buddhist style. And so, of course, most of the Japanese people at the time died a Buddhist and they were, you know, they were prisoners to local temples. So there was a mass outcry from the families of the war dead and also local elites to the army, saying that we need to have Buddhist rituals as well, because we find Shinto death rituals very alien to us. So eventually, and quite quickly, the army kind of had to change and offer. They have instructions on how to sort of process or how to do funerals for the dead soldiers. So they gave the first instruction, officially they'll say, we would prefer you to do the Shinto style funerals. But in failing that, this is how you do it in the Buddhist style. So soon they began to have options on how things could be done. So I followed the death of one non-commissioned officer. So he's not actually the officer class, but in the kind of more lower ranks, and discovered that this individual had been buried and commemorated in 7 different places over time. And so I'm just going to tell you what happened to this person after death. So, as you know, almost all of these, burials are kind of symbolic burials. And on battlefield, obviously, when you die, it's very difficult to distinguish bodies and particularly individuals. And the bodies in the Japanese case often got cremated, although not all the time. Sometimes they were buried, as you saw in the evidence provided before. And they were normally marked by a wooden pillar grave marker. So you see these little wooden pillars in battlefields, and they would signify the death of certain soldiers in the area. But in the Japanese tradition, you actually really need a relic of the dead. So how do you do this? You don't even know who these people are who died. So they would often go and cut hairs of almost like any soldier. And then you get 2 or 3 strands of the hairs and put it in a specially made box, which was like a tiny little coffin box. But it wasn't called coffin, it was called ikotsu, which means the body, the bones of the dead. But there were actually a few strands of hairs. And then they would be packed properly and sent back to the home regiments back in Japan. And it was this little box with the name of the individual soldier would be sent to the village for the village funeral. So it's a very significant symbolic thing, this box. And so, of course, with the village funeral, with the war dead from that village, the family would take that box and bring it to the family grave. So that's the second place where they sort of get symbolically buried. And then thirdly, they also get symbolically buried in the army burial ground. So in this guy's case that I studied, it was in right in the middle of Tokyo, Gokokuji, which is a big famous temple. And during the war, because there were much more death than usual, the army often used this combined tombstone called Gosohi, without inscribing the individual names and ranks of the war dead. And then there was the county war monument, which was done by the Tama County. And they were held in Hachioji, which is quite far, but close to where they came from, as one of the 214 war dead from that county. And then, of course, they were buried in the Yasukuni Shrine as one of the new 88,000 kamis to have created. Because when you died a war death, then you become a god in this Yasukuni system. And they were sort of enshrined in the Yasukuni Shrine, which still stands in Tokyo today. And then, sixthly, the village where this guy came from, Minamimura village, they also established the war monument in 1912. And from 1910 onwards, the army introduced this Imperial Reservist Association, which meant that almost everybody who, basically, in order to sort of control the veterans who came back from the war, because they were very worried about the negative impact of the veterans on their home communities. So they wanted to keep an eye on them and to make sure that they could be mobilized again if there was another war. And so he became sort of incorporated as one of the 11 in this village war monument. And finally, because he came from a, you know, slightly well-off background, his family created a private individual monument in the family compound. So altogether, this person had 7. But just by judging from the different ranks of the burial sites, most of the soldiers would have had at least 6 of them, right? You may not have had the final private one in your back garden, but most of them would have had probably at least 6 symbolic sites of burial. So this seemingly excessive process of management of the war dead was deemed crucial by the army, especially in order to justify the sacrifices made and yet to be made. Right, so this is a photograph of the funeral from the of the war dead from the front by the Third Army. So this kind of scene was recreated in many, many fields, battlefield fronts during the war. And they also, after a while, began to have sort of like ceremonies commemorating these war dead. So if you read the diaries of conscripts, you will see a lot of occasions where they said, oh, there's another commemoration festival. Oh, we can have more sake today. You know, that kind of, because it was seen to be an occasion where soldiers can relax a little bit more. They can have a little bit more food than usual and a little bit more sake and cigarettes than usual. This is a village funeral for the war dead. And then this is the triumphal homecoming of the soldiers after the war. And this is again in the Hachioji city in the outskirts of Tokyo in 1906. And they built this tremendously tall, it was about 14 meters of plaster made triumphal arch. And you may see some similarities, or maybe you don't, with L'Arc de Triomphe. It's supposed to be like L'Arc de Triomphe, but you see the symbols of the Navy and the Army, and also the laurel wreath in the top of the tree. It's quite vague, so you may not be able to see it. But it says, you know, welcome back, committee, congratulations on triumph, that sort of thing. Okay, so conclude. Yes. So the war diaries of soldiers from the war offer a unique and invaluable insight into the social world of conscripts. And as I said, it's particularly the case because of the very little censorship in this period. And then diaries, I hope you got the point I made, is that the importance of the mobilization journey within Japan, which helped to bond conscripts with Japanese people through this space of Japan. And this is the first time many conscripts begin to have positive identification with the nation. And previously, the strong local and regional identity sort of merges into the national identity of becoming Japanese. For the conscripts, filial piety was the core value. And honorable war death was actually not. And it was, as I said, it was an official rhetoric that rang hollow and meaningless to many of them. Nevertheless, the state developed an elaborate process of funerals and commemoration rituals in order to honor the war death, in order to make their death meaningful. From the official narrative of Meiji nationalism, which was still in the making. So thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.